From Bandon, Oregon, welcome to another edition of the KBOG Soundcheck. I'm Chip Kassin. Today, I interview Emmy Award-winning composer Michael Whalen, a name that might not ring a bell, or a man you might not recognize on the street, but whose music you have probably heard a thousand times, as he is one of those rare musicians that film directors go to in order to make a scene in a movie or a TV show to strike you in ways that you may not even be aware by using a layer of music to deliver a deeper message in the scene. There are only a few in the world that can do what Michael does through music and do it well. He is of a rare breed. You can easily check him out on YouTube by typing in Michael Whalen. That's MichaelWhalen. The following interview was performed during the spring 2020 COVID-19 pandemic, when shelter-in-place orders were in effect and we were all told to physically distance from each other. This is to explain that this interview took place over the phone with patchy equipment, and so audio might vary in quality as the interview progresses. You are listening to KBOG Dark Coast Radio, 97.9 FM, Bandon, Oregon. The following conversation has been edited for clarity and length. Enjoy.
I'm looking through your bio. You were born on Long Island.
I have Long Island in my history.
You have Boston. You have in your history, yeah?
I do. 4.5 years in Boston.
Yeah, true. Berklee College of Music?
Music. I went there, and then I was also a professor there.
You came back. What was it like coming back 15 years later?
Weird. Because, I mean, yeah, because, I mean, when I went there in the 80s, it was like, you know, still kind of the school of like Pat Metheny and like, you know, 1,000 guitar players. And then I go back there in 2000, and they were just at the beginning of becoming sort of a institution that was very brand centric. They became very sort of entrepreneurial, and they were doing all of those co-ventures. Yes. Yeah. So it was like, it was really strange. Taught at City College of New York. I taught at NYU. I've taught at the New School, taught at Berklee. And it's one of the reasons why I don't teach anymore. It's because I think the academic people kind of looked at me kind of like, who's this guy? And I'm like, well, I'm just a guy who is doing what I'm doing, and I teach occasionally.
So you didn't come through the normal channels to them.
No. Like I kind of fell out of space. And
right. So my father-in-law was an architect, and he ended up getting architectural licenses in various states, but he never went to college. And he eventually becomes campus architect out at the University of Massachusetts out in Amherst.
Sure.
And he didn't last a couple of years because they just didn't understand him.
Yeah.
You know, he never had the college degree, you know. Where's your bachelor's? Well, you know, I've been building buildings and houses for 30 years.
Yeah, that's kind of how I felt. I kind of felt like, hey, well, you know, I've done all this music and I've won some Emmys and I've done this stuff. And they were like, yeah, but, you know, where's your PhD from? And I'm like, I don't have one. You got to climb up, and not everyone is happy. I mean, my father said something to me when I was 11, which was really, really important. He's like, you know what? Not everyone's going to be excited about your success.
Oh.
And at 11, I was like, what do you mean? He's like, well, you're going to be successful, and not everyone's going to be happy for you. And some of those people are going to be some of the people who are closest to you. So I remember the night that I won my second Emmy. You know, I texted my entire family, hey, I won, it's great. And I didn't hear from anyone except from my mother.
Well, because your mother loves you no matter what, right?
Well, yeah, but I mean, and my best friend called me and said, hey, you won, that's great. But like, you know, in the rest of the world, it's kind of like, well, okay, well, you were sort of supposed to win. I'm like, ah.
Well, let's also say this. I mean, I, you know, you eventually go off and attain some success. Do you, when you're with people that you grew up with or people who you had a musical career with, do you just try to downplay it at this point and just say, hey, you know, it's nothing?
Well, or you don't talk about it. It's like religion and politics. You don't talk about your success. So you're like, hey, how are you? And how are your kids? And you just, I mean, you just don't do it. And then, you know, last year I got this job to become the head of A&R and the general manager of this label, which is now kind of becoming like the label in new age mindful ambient music. And everyone's like, how in the world did that happen? And I'm like, I don't know. I mean, like, I got a phone call. I don't know.
After listening to some of your music, I feel like we share similar tastes. I was always an early listener of Pink Floyd, you know?
Yeah.
Music that you can study with, and it'll just play in the background. It sort of fits the mood. You can turn the lights down and write, you can read, and it's just music that plays in the background and sort of complements anything that you're doing. You know, so I play Hans Zimmer, Steve Jablonski, Michael Schirra, I mean, Max Richter.
Wow.
And I've seen you describe it in your interviews that, you know, these really emotive moments in music, sometimes the music that's played in movies behind that is just beautiful.
It is. It really is. And what's interesting, Ellie, you talk about a guy like you know, Max Richter. I mean, he hits a chord and you're just like, there's so much happening right now. You know, it's just like, oh, you know, just the guy he's unbelievable. It's unbelievable music.
When I was starting to farm off this show, I was trying to convince people, because I say movie music and they think musicals. Well, no, it's not musicals. It's just all this emotive stuff, like in Game of Thrones, right? I mean, there are certain shows that have done music really, really, really well, right? Game of Thrones is one of them. Lost was one of them.
Yep.
Michael Giacchino, the stuff that he did was beautiful.
It's beautiful. I mean, and he's a great writer. I mean, the first 5 minutes of Up, I would put that against any 5 minutes of any movie ever made.
You know, yeah. But it's the same kind of thing where I listen to your stuff. And I think at some point you've been described as a sound design. You know, it's like, how do you, it's almost beyond music where you try to talk to people about music. Well, music isn't what's on a sheet. Music is just putting sounds together so it fits.
Sure. I mean, I think that's partially true. I mean, as a sound designer, what you want to do is you're trying to take the melody and the harmony that you've created and say, I want to try to put this in some sort of context. I mean, if it was like an orchestra, you'd say, okay, well, I'm going to have the oboe play this and I'm going to have the strings, like, you know, play like, you know, the chordal stuff or whatever. But as a sound designer, you've got literally millions and millions and millions of permutations of things that you can be doing, where you can be either taking created sound from a synthesizer or a guitar that you process or something like that, or you can be creating a sound literally out of the air and saying, okay, maybe it's a non-tonal sound, maybe it's a sound that started as like your light bulb buzzing and all of a sudden you're going to tune it and you're going to kind of create something cool out of it. But I think the most important thing that you can be doing as a sound designer is making sure that the music, the intention of the music, is actually fulfilled. So it's not about like a, hey, look at me, isn't this a cool sound that I've created? It's, you've created such a cool emotional experience that the sounds and the music and everything are all kind of like, it becomes sort of one gesture. And if you've done that, then you've done a lot.
Thank you.
you said about how you start with a theme and an idea, and you said that you often take your song titles first.
I do.
And your album covers and think, well, you know, let's just start with these ideas, and then see what music comes out of those.
That's right. I mean, because I think what happens is it helps sort of organize things programmatically. So if I have a title, then it's inferring a character. It's probably even inferring some sort of like story arc to it. So now out of the title, I have got a beginning and middle and end. And now I'm like, okay, so what's the music that's going to inhabit this conversation?
So the title of the album, you mean?
Well, the title of the album, but also the title of the song. So, like, I had all 10 titles before the music for them was finished. So like, you know, so for me, it was a really great way of organizing my thoughts and saying, okay, well, here's the, basically I'm sort of writing at a title and saying, you know, and sometimes I keep the title and occasionally I don't, but very often I do. And for Sacred Spaces, I had all 10 titles before the music was done.
Right, so the titles are just something that you'll overhear in conversation or you'll be reading somewhere and you say, wow, that's a really nice title.
Or I might, just, you know, just have an idea. I mean, for me, you know, a lot of the album is both my own experiences, like 1,000 Paper Cranes came out of me actually going to Japan and going to the Peace Museum and, you know, in Hiroshima and like having the experience of seeing thousands and thousands of paper cranes. So that was actually an experience where you have like, you know, an ocean of candlelight was actually me being in Paris at this cathedral, Saint-Eustache, which basically has no light at all, no electric light at all. And it's literally all candles. And so it was so those are literal experiences that came out of my life that, you know, created a piece of music. But there's other things like the afterlife, which is, you know, I am a Catholic, but I'm also somebody who has a very kind of strange relationship with my own religion and saying, why are we spending all this time talking about life after death when we're alive? Like, why are we spending all this time like talking about heaven and talking about the next life and talking about how much better it is when we have all of this life to be living now? So that came out of, that actually came out of a semi argument that I was having with a friend who is very religious and very kind of committed to, like, you know, the afterlife. I was like, you know, with all respect, I'm looking at this and saying, look, you know, I think that's great that that's what you believe, but I like want to live in the present. I want to live in the now, because who knows what's going to happen on the other side of this. And so am I going to like be floating around in the great, you know, abyss going, oh, gee, you know, I could have had a great experience on Earth, but I was spending all this time thinking about the afterlife that like I wasn't living my life.
It goes back. You have a video on your website, michaelwhalen.com. And I think the video is Ordinary Miracles, which is a beautiful video.
Thank you.
I'll say, because at first I wondered, well, what does he mean by ordinary miracles? And then, of course, it opens up with a quote from Albert Einstein.
That's the quote, man. I heard that quote and I was like on the floor. So
that's the quote. That's what I want.
That's the quote. And I'm like, you know, it's like either you can live your life like nothing's a miracle, or you can live your life like everything is a miracle.
And the video is a beautiful video of all these common occurrences that all you have to do is notice them. You know,
that's right.
All it takes. It's like, just open your eyes and see the amazing things that are happening around you.
Yeah. Well, because I mean, the thing is that even in self-isolation, here we are in, you know, coronavirus land, and there is miracles happening everywhere. And it's like, how present do you want to be for your world no matter what's happening? Because I think the thing is that if people think that their lives are going well, you know, of course, everything's great. And like, you know, this, the sun is smiling at me and whatever. But what if you haven't gone outside in 2 months. And what if, like, you know, maybe things aren't that great, or maybe you're like really struggling with what's going on. Can you still see the miracles that are around you? Because the thing that I love about the Einstein quote is it's a choice. You're making a choice to either see the miracles or to like pretend like none of them exist. And like, and as a human being, I think that one of the few things that we have is choice. I think one of the few things that we have is our ability to choose, you know what, I choose love, I choose the miracles, I choose it. And some people would say, well, you know, you're just deluding yourself, you know, come on. And it's like, no, actually, I actually choose to see the miracles. Like if I decide that what I'm looking at is something that's miraculous to me, guess what it is? It's just, because in a way, that's kind of like what the whole point of the entire album is. Because people go, oh, well, your album is Sacred Spaces. It's got to be religious. It is. It's all about what touches your spirit. I try very hard to stay away from, you know, evangelical or like, you know, trying to be somebody who's like sort of proselytizing for a sort of point of view.
Not in the God sense, just in the life sense.
Okay. I mean, yeah, I mean, there's people in the world who are evangelical for their jobs. Like they're.
No, I don't mean them.
No. Okay, good. So what I'm talking about is Sacred Spaces is all about gratitude. So it's like literally in any moment, the space between me and you could be sacred. Like, because like this is an important conversation, or this is something that's made a really big difference to me. My children. My relationship with my kids, no matter where they are, they're both in college and they both, you know, travel all over the place. But that's a sacred space because of the relationship. The relationship I have with my wife is a sacred space. Like my memories, the memories that like feed me and create who I am. Those are sacred spaces. So it's like it's not like the literal space. I can say, hey, I had this unbelievable afternoon in Hiroshima going to the Peace Park and that was a sacred space because of the memory. But it's not like the literalness, because I think people are walking the earth looking for that sacred space or that sacred relationship versus creating it for themselves. And I think it's all about our ability to create. Can you actually create the spiritual in your life? Can you actually create the sacred? Can you actually come from gratitude? Can you actually choose the miracles the way Einstein was talking about? And that's, you know, I'm 54 years old. I've had a very successful career in music. And I think that what this album is about me expressing gratitude on a completely new level and saying, you know what? There are things in my life that are sacred to me, and there's a lot of stuff that's not, but the stuff that's sacred to me is really sacred to me. And really starting to like parse out, like, here's what's important and here's what's not important, and coming to a real clarity about things. And I think it comes out in the music as well.
Thank you.
Would you say that your life has changed at all with the onset of the pandemic?
It's a good question. Yeah, I mean, I you know, I'm a guy who has probably walked 30,000 miles in New York City, literally. So, like, I have walked 3 New York City marathons for charity, and I love walking. So, like, on a normal day, I'll walk 10 or 15 miles a day. And now I'm walking like a mile and a half, 2 miles. And basically I'm just walking, you know, walking around the block a lot with my dog. And my dog's like, dude, we got to go back outside. But so, you know, in 2001, I moved back to New York City, and I've been in New York ever since, in various, you know, like I was in Manhattan and then I was in Brooklyn. And then my wife and I just moved to the Bronx. So now I'm in the Bronx.
And all those stereotypes that you used to throw about casually, you're in the Bronx.
That's right. I'm in the Bronx. How you doing? Hey, how you doing? No, but I mean, and the thing that's, we live in a beautiful building in the Bronx, and we're as south as you can get in the Bronx. Like, literally, like, if you walk across the Willis Avenue Bridge, you're already in Manhattan, and that's like 100 yards from our house. So, I mean,
it's such a different place in the north.
It's so weird up there. It's like, you know, northern Harlem and all that is so weird.
Okay, you've been to the Cloisters?
Oh, sure.
Oh, my God. It's like I was living on East 3rd Street, and we decided to take the train up to the Cloisters one day. And it takes like over an hour, right? It's like going out to the beach in Brooklyn. It's like, how can we be in the five boroughs? And it takes me an hour to get to the north of Manhattan, and then you're on this train and you're starting to go through what you expect in New York City, but then it turns into like green and lush and then hilly. And you think, how can this be Manhattan?
Yeah, it's weird. Because so welcome to Inwood. So yeah, it's very strange. And the thing that's really interesting is that I'm so far south in the Bronx that our house lines up with 125th Street in Manhattan. So like, if you look at a map, there's like, you know, the Bronx kind of comes down like a bump, the southern part of it, and New York kind of goes up like a bump, and it goes way up into like 181st Street. So, so we are very far south, and people are like, well, you're in the Bronx. It must be really hard to get to. It's like, no, not really. You should look at a map. But my wife works in the court system here, and I could work on the dark side of the moon. It doesn't matter. But for her, it's very important to be here in the city, and her and her colleagues are doing unbelievable work during the pandemic. You know, they've created a virtual courtroom online, and they're doing emergency cases. They're doing 30, 40 emergency cases online every day. And the work they're doing is absolutely unbelievable. It's just, you know, so they're trying to keep the wheels of justice moving for people, and they're trying to get it so people are protected and they get what they need. But It's been unbelievable.
Remember what 9/11 did to the firefighters, right?
Yeah.
You would think that the pandemic is going to do similar for all the healthcare workers, all the grocery workers, you know, just people who have these jobs that you need.
Yeah. It's Every time I go to the supermarket, I thank people. I thank the lady at the cash register. Thank you so much, because it's just unbelievable what they're doing. It's just unbelievable. They're putting their lives on the line, and you know, I think a lot of people took people for granted. I mean, I'll take responsibility that, like, there's people that I took for granted. I'm not taking any of them for granted now.
Invisible people. And I was, when I was in Boston, I was a cab driver for 5 years, and I always thought of myself as an invisible person, which means that, you know, you get in a cab, you drive, you pay the guy, and you never really notice him.
Yep.
You know, and the same thing with the cashier. It's like, you know, you can go in a store and not even notice the person that you're handing money to. You know, they have a life, they have a family, they have kids.
That's right.
So it's nice to see the recognition. visit it, right, for a moment.
Sure.
I'm looking at your website, michaelwhalen.com, and you have amazing things on this website, but really interesting to me is this picture of you in your studio. I count 13 keyboards.
It's worse now. That's actually an old picture. So, yeah.
I see two different mixers. I see keyboards with mixers on them. I see what is probably your main keyboard, big gray thing.
Yeah. That's it.
Which probably is super powerful for its moment. But then I'm thinking, seeing these other keyboards with various architectural generations of knobs. You know, it's almost like museum pieces.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I have what's funny is everyone's like, wow, you've got all this old gear. And it's like, no, it's actually reissued gear. So I have a Moog modular that was just built like a year ago, but it was built the way it was built in 1971. So everyone's like, well, you've got really old gear. And I was like, no, I have brand new gear, but it was built the way it was built 40 years ago. So,
but some of these must be comfort keyboards, which means that they've been with you for so long. You don't really use them, but they've been with you.
No.
They're like old friends.
No. I my room in the Bronx is 10 feet by 12 feet. I do not have any room for any of that stuff. Everybody in my studio has got to like show up and actually like earn their space, because I mean
the picture that I'm looking at, there's no room for a second person. But are you saying that you actually put a second person in there?
Oh no, it's just me. Like I'm the only person in there.
Now if that's your studio,
yeah,
you must not use mics, because I don't see any silent dampening equipment in there on the walls.
I have baffles and stuff low, and actually this room is actually, I'm actually in the room right now and I'm talking into my Neumann right now. So, I mean, I actually record, sometimes I do vocals, sometimes I do things, but very often if I'm going to do anything that needs or wants a sound of a room, I don't do it here. Like I'll go to someone else's studio. And for Sacred Spaces, I recorded a lot of percussion and I went to a studio for that. And I went to a lot of my friends' studios who have synthesizers that I don't have. And I made, you know, sounds and textures that I actually, threw on a computer disc and I came back with it. But a lot of what I do, it's true, is, you know, keyboard oriented, into the computer, into the processors. But but what's been really interesting with me, you know, with this particular project is, you know, it's sort of the acoustic sound processed versus the synthesized made from nothing sound. And, you know, so for Sacred Spaces, I probably made about almost 900 sounds for it, probably 850, 875 sounds for it. And I would say you could probably split down the middle, like the acoustic sounds that I use, like the guitar sounds and the percussion sounds. And I did a lot of treated stuff with vocals. And
I think to a trained musical ear, you can do that, yes.
And what's really interesting is that people are always talking about, you know, wow, you know, this album sounds unbelievable because, you know, I've never heard a sound like that. And I'm like, yeah, but which one of the 200 sounds on the song are you talking about? So one of the things that I did on this record, which I think is new for me, is early in my career, I started as a commercial sound designer for advertising, which is you're doing sound effects, you're creating sound for, you know, all kinds of different motion. Like if a car drives by, you're doing the whoosh, you're doing all that stuff. And for a long time, I was having a hard time figuring out how I was going to take that experience with the thousands of commercials that I worked on, and how was I going to sort of bring this into my music. And I think for a long time, I sort of pretended like I didn't have that experience. I was trying to be like a more sort of traditional composer or a pianist or whatever. And then on this record, I was just like, you know, I'm sorry. I have decades of experience as an award-winning sound designer. Let's bring it in. So Sacred Spaces is really, I think, the first time in my entire career where my life as a composer and my life as a sound designer have come together, and they've kind of like found a place to kind of sort of groove together. And I'm so happy with how it's come out, because I think for a long time I was having a hard time with the whole sound thing. I you know, because I didn't know what to do with it, and you know, I wanted to kind of like try to fit in with other people, and I was like, no, that's not me. I'm not being my real true self. So you'll see that there's a lot of sounds on this album that you probably have never heard before. And there's a lot of stuff that I'm doing where you'll hear a tonal sound, you know, like a sound that has a harmony to it. And then behind it, there will be a non-tonal sound. And they set things off very nicely to each other. And it gives the album and the entire song like so much space and depth. So it's been a really cool experience to kind of rediscover myself and kind of put myself back together again.
So one more question about your studio, and then I want to ask you about your first life. Right, you talked about your life as a sound designer and then as a composer, but you had a first life as a drummer. But
I did.
Well, let me first ask about, I have one more studio question. I won't ask about the guitars because I think they're interesting. You have four guitars in here. I don't have time. I probably don't have time to ask about that. But you have this interesting, way on the back shelf, it looks like you have a little figurine of a guitar smashing his guitar. What is that thing?
Oh, well, the figurine on the shelf, that is actually Keith. That's Keith Emerson.
Is he smashing his guitar? What's he doing?
No, he is playing his Hammond.
Oh, the Hammond organ. Okay, that big organ.
Yeah,
he was one of the first Moog guys.
That's right, and his Moog modular is on top of the organ.
Is the proper pronunciation Moog?
Moog. That's right. Everyone says it wrong. Everyone says Moog. It's Moog.
Okay. Do you have some awards back there too on those shelves?
I do. Yeah, I have my BMI award and my two Emmys.
All right. So that's my studio questions. I could probably talk about the studio for another hour. As I see. No, but okay. So you started off not with piano. You actually,
no.
you talk about your grandma playing piano and how she was doing swing, jazz,
all that stuff.
Right.
All that stuff.
But then when you first took a bite out of your musical life as a teenager, you played drums.
That's right. I actually started drums when I was five, and my parents bought me a drum set when I was five, and my mother is a saint. And I, you know, I got lessons right away. And
but is that what you wanted? You wanted drums?
I wanted to be a drummer. I wanted drums.
Okay.
And you know, and I played drums a lot really into college. And then, you know, when I went to Berkeley, it was, dude, you got to choose. You know, like, are you going
to
do the keyboard thing?
So by the time
you
got to Berkeley, you had already established something of a piano expertise or no?
Yeah. I mean, I had already played keyboards for like 4 or 5 years. I had a couple of keyboards. I had a couple of synthesizers, you know, that I was already messing around with. And so it was like, you know, which way are you going to go? And so I think for me, it was never about becoming like a great keyboardist. It was always, I want to be a composer. And the fastest and most expedient way to get my stuff out is by playing keyboards.
Okay, so in my Boston days where I was a cab driver, and I was in my 20s like you, you know, you end up going to parties, drinking with people, and you run into people from Berklee College of Music, right? And
sure.
I remember talking to people that were going to school there. I actually saw Tom Waits there one night.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and he was in his prime. He was funny. He was musical. He was great, right? And he had the rough voice.
That's right.
The piano's been drinking, not me. All that kind of stuff. So I talked to these kids from Berklee College of Music, and I remember one of them speaking rather eloquently about what he was doing. He goes, you know, when you go to Berklee College of Music, he goes, my aim is to be a studio musician, which means that when I walk into a studio and they say, you need to play in this style, I can do it right away. Or you need to play like Jimi Hendrix, you need to play like Eric Clapton, you need to be, you know, you need to play like B.B. King. He goes, any style that they throw at me, I'm going to school so that I can play any style of music. I can be a studio musician and do well. Mm. And that was my impression of what Berklee did, was it teaches you everything. Is that true?
It does. Yeah, sort of. I mean, you know, as a guy who has taught now at several schools, I will say there are things that you cannot really teach. I mean, I can teach you theory. I can teach you harmony. I can teach you the basic building blocks. But how are you going to use that is going to be up to you. I think one of the big missings, and I will say this, and this will be controversial, and I apologize to everybody. I think one of the big missings in any sort of music education right now is music business. And so I had a very successful music business class that I taught at the City College of New York for years.
I saw that. How to monetize your musical skills, copyright,
that's right.
Expertise.
That's right. That's right. And so, you know, so one of the things I did with my kids was we had conversations about contracts. We had conversations about how things are defined. We had conversations about, like, what is publishing? What is sub-publishing? Like when you write a piece of music and you record it, you're actually creating two copyrights, not one. I mean, so we would have all of these conversations and, you know, I would say out of the 150 kids that went through my class, a third of them got record and publishing deals.
Shifting gears because we have limited time.
Sure.
I'm interested in your layers. I mean, what I see is I see that you got a set of drums when you were five, and then you become a drummer in a punk rock band or, you know, whatever it was. But then, you know, you're constantly surrounded by peers who are in groups like you, and yet you rise up.
Yeah.
And what was it that led you to rise up? I mean, when I was in Boston, I met a lot of 40-year-old rock guys who played at the Rat, you know, and they never really made it up through the other layers. But what was it in you? You know, how did you go from a punk band up to interviewing to go to Berklee College of Music?
I think I was always inspired by the music and the music makers. Like at that point, it was the early 80s, and I was listening to Quincy Jones, and I was listening to like David Foster's early stuff. And I was like, I was always like blown away with the producers, like these guys who had a handle on the music side and the business side. And like Michael O'Martian, who like did all that stuff for Donna Summer and Christopher Cross and whatever. Like he started his career as a lawyer and then became a music producer and then a label guy. Like I always thought that was like really interesting, saying, okay, how do you essentially create that whole thing? I mean, people like Will Ackerman, who started Windham Hill as an artist, and then you create a amazingly successful record label. How do you do that? And so,
but you also had to have proved yourself multiple times, because to rise up through the layers, don't you have moments where people throw things at you?
Oh, sure.
And you have to prove your mettle.
Yeah, you do. You do. I mean, the thing is that I always had a weird relationship with myself as a player, and I still do. I have it like I'm not a player, and people are always like, dude, you can play your butt off. And I'm like, yeah, you know, thanks. But I have a weird relationship with it because I always feel like I I was not one of those kids at Berkeley who spent 1,000 hours in a practice room. I was not that guy. I was the guy who was like programming sounds for people in the recording studio and like, you know, and trying to do that and trying to get as much information about music publishing and trying to get as much information about like songwriting and like, and like, and processes. Like I became a process
guy.
So
you had a professional relationship to music.
I did. I really did. And I, and early on, and you know, I, the very first like commercial thing I ever did was when I was 16, I was at a music store outside of Washington, D.C., Chuck Levin's Washington Music Center, which is still there. It's still my favorite music, favorite music store in the world. And I was playing on, I don't know what keyboard. And some guy who worked for the NBC affiliate was like, wow, you're really good. We have a thing coming up. You should take a shot at it. And at that point, John Williams had just written the new theme for NBC, and they wanted their own version of it, but done on synthesizer.
Do you ever thank people like that?
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
There's for helping.
That's my guy was a guy named Tommy Wardlow, who was the chief percussionist at the Kennedy Center in Washington. He was my drum teacher.
And he lifted you up?
And he lifted me up when I was 13 and 14. He said to me, do not be me. Do not be a guy who has a gig waiting for the guy in front of you to either die or move away. Like, you have a talent for being a composer. Go do that. Because how you are going to lift yourself up in music is not by being a player. How you're going to lift yourself up is by being a writer and having some control over your life. So he is the guy who said, dude, like, there are two roads here. One is being a player, where you have really kind of no control over anything. And the other one is by being a writer. And, you know, it was 10 years later. And I was in New York and I was basically like freelancing for everybody. I was making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. And I sent him a card and I said, Tommy, thank you from the bottom of my heart. And he wrote me this beautiful letter back. And for years we corresponded back and forth. And it was one of those things where for him, he was so happy that I made the choice that I did and I got myself out. Like, he was like, cool, you're good.
Right. How do you feel about being relatively transparent compared to, I mean, you do have quite a name for yourself right now, but a lot of stuff you do is stuff that people would recognize, but they would never know it's you because it's in the commercial sphere. You know,
that's
it's in commercials, it's TV shows. I mean, in a way, a bit like Hans Zimmer, where, you know, people outside of the industry really don't know him. You know,
that's true. It's true. I mean, and there's actually something really, really nice about it. I remember being at a restaurant in Malibu. And I'm not one of these like name dropper, like, hey, I'm at Malibu. But like, I'm literally at a table in Malibu with me and five of my friends who all happen to be TV and film composers. And between the six of us, we have a absolutely astounding breadth of work. And all these people are like sort of buzzing around, like doing like the Hollywood LA thing. And nobody has any idea who we are. It's fabulous.
It's almost like being an alien visiting the planet Earth. Like, nobody knows who you are.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, it's kind of like, it's kind of cool that you can like work at the top level of your business and you're not going to get hassled for walking down the street. So
New York is a perfect city for that.
It absolutely is. It's such a great place to be anonymous. It's so great.
Even if you're well known. I mean, well known. People love it because New Yorkers have this attitude where you know, we're mostly going to leave you alone.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. You know. That's right. And now you wear a mask and nobody really knows who you are now.
Okay, so you have a new album out, Sacred Spaces.
I do. It's a new album out, Sacred Spaces.
Yes, and the Ordinary Miracles is seems like one of your showcase songs that you're showing right on your website.
It is, and it's done. You know, the video is done great. It's done great on radio all over the world.
Do you put it together yourself?
I did.
That's amazing.
One of the weird things that's happened to me in the last 5 or 7 years is I had to edit something as. I forget what the project was, but like the house was burning down and basically like, hey, dude, like you like jump on Final Cut Pro and go make something happen. 7 years later, I have edited probably 500 pieces, including some documentaries and some long form stuff and whatever. I love it. I love working with Pitcher. I love cutting stuff. I love it.
So you become something of a videographer then.
Well, I mean, I think the thing, and this is sort of the speech that I gave my son who wants to go into film and TV, which is, you know, when I was growing up, it was all about how much of a specialist can you be? I think now, you know, my son is 19 years old. It's how much of a generalist can you be? So, like, can you basically be somebody who has ideas, but can you execute them in two or three or four different kinds of modalities? And so now I'm 54 years old, and I went from being a guy who was very, very, very specific to, you know, now 5 decades later, becoming much more of a generalist. So I think I'm trying to keep up with, you know, like my 20-year-old self.
Right. So,
yeah.
You know, and those are the kind of people, those generalists who could just look at something, a problem, and go, I think I'll try this. Or you just start trying everything until something works.
Well, I mean, I think there's that. And then there's also the reality of the record business where I don't have a budget to hire someone to sit in front of a computer for 200 hours and do what needs to be done to a piece of video. So it's like, if I'm not going to do it myself, then there is literally no budget to hire anyone to do this. And I'm not going to ask somebody to do it as a favor. So I think part of it is like self-preservation that says, okay, I need to make quality video content and I need somebody who's going to care about it as much as me. So I guess it's me.
Okay, well, I just point to your mom and dad on that, because to be able to do something like that, to walk into a challenging environment and figure out, you know what, I can do it. That comes from confidence.
Oh yeah. I mean, and my parents were always so, so supportive of me.
I remember my parents always saying, don't let anybody ever tell you that you can't do something.
Amen.
You know, I did once. Oh yeah. I wanted to comment on your album title, Sacred Spaces, that when I think about any artistic endeavor, It's not just the spaces, but it's actually Günter Grass, who's a German novelist. Mm-hmm. He one time said, art is the capturing of a moment. You know, so when I think about the creation of art, in the small amount of times that I've been involved in it, you usually find yourself in a moment that's really moving, that inspires you to do something, to create something. Mm. You know, so I'm wondering about your sacred moments. I mean, surely you have in your video of various being out in nature kind of thing.
Yep, that's right.
And you must have had moments where you think that, wow, this is a moment that I need to capture somehow.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I'm not one of these people who is like, I'm going to go rent a house in Ireland so I can have an experience so I can go write a novel about it. I'm not one of those people. I am a person who is going to live my life, and my job is to keep my eyes open. So, like, for a perfect example.
And find those miracles.
So last summer, my wife and I, we rented a house way up north in California on Humboldt Bay, which is beautiful. And I had no idea where we were going or what we were doing, except that it's 250 miles north from San Francisco. And it was going to be an adventure. And we had the most beautiful time because I didn't walk in with any sort of like preconceived notions of what was going to happen. And it was one of, you know, we've gone on a bunch of trips together, but it was one of the most sort of photographed experiences that I've had pretty much in my life, because it was literally every time I turned around, there was like something that was like more beautiful than the last thing that we just saw.
Was that north of Eureka? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. It's beautiful. It's desolate. It's like you and like the lumber trucks and, you know, and you go and you see the water and it is breathtaking. But I was so happy that I had not done any of that homework on where you should go, what you should do. We literally just like got to the house. We just showed up and it was awesome. We had the best time. And so to me, like, that was a sacred space, because I have that memory, and that's, you know, and my wife and I have talked about it 100 times since we gotten back. It's been wonderful.
I try to explain to people what beaches are like up there. It's like, well, it's not like LA where you go out on the beach and there's a million people. You go out on the beach and there's no one.
No one for hours. Like you and the beaches are wide and beautiful and clean. And it was like me and my wife, and we brought our dog, and we literally hung out for hours. We did not see another human being. And this is August. There was nobody there.
It's almost like post-apocalyptic.
Post pandemic or whatever. But it was like there was nobody there. And it was just gorgeous. And so to me, it's like, I think for me, the most wonderful experience I've had in my life have been the surprises. You know, I think, you know, I'm a guy who I like to prepare and I like to be ready for things, but I'm always, I always remember the surprises. It's always like, wow, I had no idea that was going to happen. Wow, that's so cool. And like you walk around the corner and all of a sudden something happens. And I love that. I love that, you know, I'm not so cynical and I'm not so kind of like, you know, beaten down by life that I can't be just sort of blown away by having like an interaction with somebody, or you meet somebody really amazing. And I think that's important, because I think we are in a very dark, cynical time right now. I think people, you know, it's very hard to kind of keep things open and trying to flow positivity. But every time I ever get into that mode, I just remember 3 things that I'm grateful for, and I get right back on the horse and off you go.
Yes. And like you said, keeping your eyes open.
That's all. I think that's really important, because I mean, I think right now it's hard to keep your eyes open. I think, you know, we're not going to talk about politics or religion, but it's a tough time right now. And I think it's the artist's responsibility to be creating a mirror for people, to be creating an experience for people, so either they can lose themselves and be transcended someplace else, or they can start taking action on their own. And I think that, like, I think as an artist right now, I have been absolutely blown away by the hundreds of people who have said, wow, you know, I've been listening to Sacred Spaces while I've been in self-isolation. Thank you. Like, this has been beautiful. Like, I've had this amazing experience. So, like, yeah, I put on the headphones and I go, you know, I'm just taken away for an hour. Thank you so much. And getting those messages from people has really made a difference for me, because this has been a tough time for people, and people are having a hard time, you know, sort of, you know, keeping, you know, focused and, you know, sort of keeping on. And if my music can help them with that, that's great.
Yes. Mm. It just centers you and settles you. Michael Whalen, I want to thank you. We've had a good hour, and I want to thank you a lot for taking the time to talk. I wish you the best of luck. I'm envious of you being in New York.
Yeah, thank you. It's you know, we are here at the Epicenter, and it's also sort of, I think, going to be the beginning of the healing.
Interesting time of history, you know. All right, Michael. I appreciate your time. Thank you very much. And best of luck with everything that you're doing. I love your music.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you so much.
All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right. Well, that was our interview with the very prolific and great composer, Michael Whalen. Thank you for listening in. I want to thank Michael for giving us the time out of his busy schedule to talk with us. Be sure to check out his new album, Sacred Spaces, on YouTube and elsewhere. And you can find out more from his website, michaelwhalen.com, spelled michaelwhalen.com. You are listening to KBOG, Dark Coast Radio, 97.9 FM, Bandon, Oregon. With what time we have left, we are going to fit into the rest of the hour a song of his entitled Kiss the Quiet. Until next time, this is KBOG Soundcheck. Be well, and see you next time.